time check. For the sound of the gong, it was 5 minutes past midnight Berlin time. The latest news from Berlin. At 7:15 this evening, the Führer once more received the British ambassador to Berlin, Sir Neville Henderson, at the new Reich Chancellery. It is learned from political circles in Berlin that on this occasion the Führer handed to the British ambassador the reply of the Reich government to the note of the British government, which had been conveyed to the Führer last night. It is stated that Reich Foreign Minister von Ribbentrop and Minister Schmidt, acting as interpreter, were also present at the reception. Sir Neville Henderson's visit to the Führer ended at 7:40 p.m., thus having lasted for 25 minutes. Generally well-informed quarters purport to know that the reply to yesterday's note of the British government will be supplemented by verbal statements on the German side. Reports of the persecution of Germans in Poland continue to fill the Berlin evening papers tonight. It is pointed out that, as the Führer had termed it, the Macedonic conditions in the corridor were still going on. The papers report on the shooting by Polish soldiers of 5 Germans who, as already announced, attempted to reach Reich territory by swimming across the River Warte. The Berlin correspondent of the Hamburger Fremdenblatt states that no actual change is to be noticed at the moment as to the general state of the crisis. Neither a change towards a relaxation nor to an intensification of the present condition. The exchange of views going on at present between Berlin and London is naturally being followed by the whole world with the closest attention. The paper emphasizes that only the removal of the old wounds, that is to say, the Danzig and corridor problem, would be able to create new conditions and more hopeful prospects for the general situation in Europe. The Deutsche Allgemeine Zeitung recalls the fact that the population of the corridor had at the time been prevented to hold a plebiscite. In the elections for the National Assembly in 1919, however, they had voted for Germany with a great majority. The terrorization of Germans by members of the Polish insurgents organization continues, according to reports in the Berlin press. Bomb outrages were committed upon the houses of 2 members of the German group in the town of Bielitz, Upper Silesia. 2 Germans, Schauer and Pitofsky, were killed. Another, Polacek, was severely injured. It is stated that Polish border officials fired at German refugees in the district of Bobek-Kaus, East Upper Silesia, who had already reached German territory. Competent quarters in Berlin energetically refute some reports and rumors circulated by the Warsaw radio. It was alleged that the Polish consulates at Breslau and Mährisch Ostrau have been closed by the German authorities, and that the Polish consul and the vice consul of Mährisch Ostrau, respectively, have not been allowed to cross the frontier. Another report of the Warsaw radio alleged that provisions stores had been plundered in Berlin and that numerous persons were arrested. It is expressly stated that these reports lack any foundation whatsoever and are pure invention from beginning to end. The Polish troops concentrated along the Danzig border are being constantly reinforced, according to reports from Danzig. Besides, 3 new main front lines have been set up towards East Prussia and the Reich. It appears that it is the Polish plan to launch an offensive upon Marienwerder, Riesenburg, and Deutsch-Eylau. The main force of the Polish army is concentrated in the corridor. The Poles have allegedly 2 million men now under arms. The Danziger Vorposten writes in this connection, taking into account the lack of discipline shown time and again by Polish troops, there is a danger that there will be serious frontier violations, even against the wish of the high command of the Polish army. Reports from various Polish camps of reservists in East Upper Silesia state that great confusion prevails among the men called to arms. The majority of the reservists still wear civilian clothes, the only outward sign that they are army men being a soldier's cap. The reports add that only a small portion of the Polish reservists could be supplied with arms, so that the soldiers have to lend their weapons to their comrades for training purposes. It is said that on account of the insufficient food supply, fighting and disobedience are the order of the day. The British Prime Minister, Mr. Chamberlain, stated in the House of Commons today that there has been but little change in the international situation since the last session of the House. The danger has not yet diminished. It will be the main principle of all further stages, so explained Mr. Chamberlain, to inform the House continuously on every development of the situation. In this connection, the British Prime Minister appealed to the English press to display the utmost reserve at a time when a few words may easily hamper all efforts made for a satisfactory solution of the crisis. No changes were made as regards the policy of the British government, so explained Mr. Chamberlain. The Premier then gave a report on the visit to the Führer of the British ambassador, Sir Neville Henderson. It had not been considered necessary in Berlin that Sir Neville Henderson should have returned to Berlin already on Saturday last. The German government was of the opinion that London was carefully studying the Berlin message. The British cabinet thus devoted Saturday and Sunday to a careful and exhaustive examination and discussion of the problem. The British Prime Minister then went on to say that the Führer in his message had expressed his desire for an Anglo-German understanding of a long and lasting character. On the other hand, however, the Führer had left no doubt as to his view regarding the urgency of a solution of the Polish problem. The British government had made it quite clear that Britain would fulfill her obligations towards Poland. Mr. Chamberlain explained that a publication of the correspondence between London and Berlin was at the moment not in the interest of the nation. The British government would welcome any opportunity to discuss the various viewpoints. The settlement, however, would depend upon the way and manner in which the actual differences with Poland could be overcome. The government was now waiting for a further reply of the Führer. The British Prime Minister said he had heard of press reports on the contents of the British reply to the Führer. Any such reports are free inventions from beginning to end. Mr. Chamberlain then stated that the entire Navy and Air Force were ready for action. It is to be hoped, however, that there will be a peaceful solution after all. Such a peaceful solution might be able to lead to a further understanding, and this in turn to a pacification of Europe and the world. Whatever there will be, war or peace, Great Britain will follow the course decided upon, emphasized Mr. Chamberlain. The English House of Commons, in which Mr. Chamberlain, as already announced, made a statement on the European situation this afternoon, was adjourned to Tuesday next week. If necessary, so explained Mr. Chamberlain, it will be summoned at an earlier date. Lord Halifax made a statement to the House of Lords similar to that of Mr. Chamberlain before the Commons. Prime Minister de Valera's statement regarding Irish neutrality has been confirmed once more by the official Irish Information Bureau. Ireland refuses to grant Great Britain the right to call to arms Irish subjects living in Great Britain. The North Irish Council addressed an appeal to President Roosevelt, asking him to exert his influence upon Britain in favor of the oppressed Irish. Great Britain's domination in the six counties of Northern Ireland, so explains the appeal, is a frightful tyranny unparalleled anywhere else in Europe. It is expected in political circles of Dublin that Prime Minister de Valera will lay down Ireland's attitude in case of war in a statement to Parliament within the next few days. It is believed in Dublin that Mr. de Valera will express the wish of his government to observe neutrality. In this connection, reference is being made to a communique of the semi-official Irish Information Service, which especially emphasizes the will for Ireland's neutrality. It was officially announced in Oslo today that the National Bank of Norway decided to use no longer the rate of the English pound as a base for its quotations. In today's session of the two chambers of its Supreme Soviet, the new bill on agricultural taxation was moved and passed. There will be no session tomorrow. For Thursday noon, the two chambers have been summoned for a hearing of an address on a proposed law for general conscription. Political circles of Tokyo are of the opinion that the list of the new Japanese cabinet will not be published before Wednesday. It is understood that Monsieur Nobuyuki will be appointed Prime Minister and will simultaneously take over the foreign and the home ministries. Secretary of State in the German Foreign Office, von Weizsäcker, today informed the ministers of Denmark and Lithuania that, in a case of conflict, Germany would respect the neutrality of these states. The King of the Belgians and the Queen of the Netherlands, as stated in Brussels by the Belgian Premier on Tuesday, have offered their services for mediation to the governments of Germany, Italy, France, Britain, and Poland. The news bulletin in English of the German shortwave station Berlin has been concluded. We are following up with the stock quotations for North America. The following prices were quoted at Hamburg on the 29th of August. Wheat and wheat bran not quoted. Lard, American steam lard transito from ship side, 18 United States dollars per 100 kilos. Copper standard per August, 55¾ marks per 100 kilos. Lead, soft delivery, 17¼ pounds per long ton. Zinc, unrefined, 18¼ marks per 100 kilos. Bremen quoted, cotton standard middling local, 9.23 United States cents per pound. London gold quotation, 157 shillings per ounce. The German shortwave stations Berlin are broadcasting today via stations DJB and DJD on the 19 and 25 meter bands. You've been listening to our news bulletin, that is our first news bulletin in English, and also to our stock quotations for North America. We're now switching back to Berlin National. For the time check first, 20 seconds to go, and with the sound of the gong, it will be 18 minutes past midnight Berlin time. Dr. Kurzwellensender Berlin, unser Nachrichten- und Wirtschaftsdienst in englischer Sprache für Nordamerika ist beendet. Wir schalten zurück zum Deutschlandsender.
The Ministry of Public Works has once more advised the population of Paris to leave the capital. The decrees issued yesterday, which provide for a severe restriction of a telephone and telegram service, are being carried out with the greatest rigidity. All public telephones have been disconnected. It is no longer permitted to telephone from restaurants, cafes, and similar places. Trunk calls can be put through from post offices only upon presentation of identification papers. Telegrams to destinations outside France must be passed by the police. Traffic in the streets of Paris, too, shows the effects of the precautionary measures taken by the government. Horse-drawn vehicles have taken the place of almost all lorries. The semi-official Moscow news agency TASS, in a statement published today, denies all rumors spread abroad, and in particular by the Neue Zürcher Zeitung, alleging that Soviet Russian troops were being withdrawn from Western Russia and that 230,000 men had already been sent as reinforcements to Russia's far eastern borders. The semi-official Soviet Russian news agency declares to have been authorized by official Moscow quarters to state that these reports are not substantiated by facts. On the contrary, so the TASS agency says, the Soviet High Command, in view of the seriousness of the European situation and taking into account the possibility of various surprises, had decided to reinforce the troops in Western Russia. In a number of other TASS reports,
attention is drawn to the feverish war preparations in Poland. The Polish state president, Monsieur Moszycki, received this afternoon Marshal Rich Smigley, Premier Sklodowski, and Foreign Minister Beck for an important conference. The Führer received the Italian ambassador, Signor Attonico, this evening. The conversation at which the Reich Foreign Minister von Ribbentrop was present lasted 15 minutes. The Luxembourg Chamber has expressed its thanks to the German and the French governments for having guaranteed the neutrality of Luxembourg in the event of war. The political quarters in Bern are not quite clear as to France's attitude towards Switzerland in the event of war, so the Tribune de Genève declares today. The paper reports that the Swiss General Staff has suggested to the Swiss Federal Council to ask France for a declaration similar to those given to Switzerland by Germany and Italy. Usually well-informed quarters in Rome report that English pounds are no longer accepted by any bank in the Italian capital. Count Sarno today received the British ambassador in Rome, Sir Percy Lorraine, for a conversation of half an hour. Marshal Balbo, Governor General for Libya, has issued a decree today providing for a central supervision of the distribution of food supplies and for a control of prices. Foodstuffs of vital importance are to be stored and to be distributed equally to all inhabitants. The Viceroy of Ethiopia, the Duke of Aosta, arrived in Addis Ababa by plane today. According to a report circulated by the Agenzia Stefani, Italian papers are to be restricted from the 1st of September to issues of 6 pages at the most. The Polish authorities have severed practically all connections between East Upper Silesia and Germany. All telephone communication has been suspended. Letters and other mail in either direction is no longer forwarded by the Polish post. Railway traffic has likewise been suspended, and the usual traffic between towns and villages on either side of the frontier has stopped completely. Frontier police, detachments of the Polish insurgents, and 3 lines of soldiers hermetically close the frontier. All these measures are intended to prevent any information on the brutal terror in East Upper Silesia from penetrating across the frontiers. Foreign countries are to be informed on conditions in Poland solely by the tendentious reports broadcast by the Polish radio and by the Polish news agency. In reality, East Upper Silesia today presents the picture of a huge prison camp. Polish hatred is now turning against the Lithuanians too. It will be recalled that Poland has a Lithuanian minority of 300,000 in Wilna, which was forcibly annexed by Poland after the war. From Lithuanian sources, it is reported that the population on the border feared a repetition of the coup which led to the occupation of Wilna, in view of the concentration of Polish troops near the Lithuanian frontier, and in view further of the increased activity of Polish secret organizations within Lithuania. The foreign ministers of the 3 Baltic states will meet for a 3-day conference on the 8th of September to discuss the present serious situation. The Bern paper Bund reports to have been informed by delegates to the Zionist Congress in Geneva that the British authorities in Palestine had ordered the mobilization of 20,000 Palestine Jews for the protection of the mandate. From the same source, the paper reports further that the radical ban on immigration into the mandate had been suspended in favor of relatives of Jews already resident in Palestine. The anti-Jewish demonstrations in Antwerp have increased to such an extent that the police have had to resort to stricter measures. 1,000 armed policemen patrolled the city on Monday night. No more than 5 persons are allowed to stand together in the streets. In Brussels, too, there have been more anti-Jewish demonstrations. In the night from Monday to Tuesday, a bomb exploded in front of a Jewish restaurant. The United States Secretary of the Treasury, Henry Morgenthau, broke off his holidays today and returned to Washington on board a coastal patrol boat. This is Berlin calling via stations DJB and DJD. Our second news bulletin in English has been concluded.
Broadcast by shortwave station 203, 9.63 megacycles, 31.13 meters. 204, 11.81 megacycles, 25.4 meters. 206, 15.3 megacycles, 19.61 meters. IRF, F for frequency, 9.83 megacycles, 30.52 meters. Here is today's news from the AR, the Italian Broadcasting System. Berlin. Chancellor Hitler today handed over to Ambassador Henderson the reply of the Reich government to the communication received from the British government last night. The reply, which was delivered at 7:15 this evening, was accompanied by some verbal explanations by the Führer. Minister von Ribbentrop was present at the conversation, which lasted about 20 minutes. London. The House of Commons, packed to its limit, assembled early this afternoon to hear from Prime Minister Chamberlain the anxiously awaited reply from Chancellor Hitler to yesterday's communication of the British government. The House, however, was informed by Mr. Chamberlain that the government was not yet in possession of it. The catastrophe, then said the Prime Minister, is not yet on us, but it cannot be said that the danger is past. Mr. Chamberlain warned the press to exercise the utmost caution and moderation in a moment in which even a few uncautious words from a smaller newspaper might destroy the results of the effort which the government is making towards attaining a satisfactory solution. Referring to the Führer's communication to the British government, Mr. Chamberlain stated that he would be glad to tell the House of the contents of the communication exchanged with the Reich Chancellor, but the members would readily understand that in a delicate moment like this, and while such a serious question are in the balance, it would not be in the public interest to make public these confidential communications or to divulge their details. Mr. Chamberlain went on to give a brief outline of these communications. The German Chancellor, he said, expressed to the British government his desire to reach a complete and lasting understanding with Great Britain. He, however, left no doubt about his determination to settle the German-Polish question as urgently as possible. Great Britain made plain that she was desirous to see a Polish-German accord materialized in a permanent way, but that all depended from the manner in which the Polish-German divergences would be handled. The British government restated at the same time that it was resolved to fulfill its obligations towards Poland. The London government has repeatedly stated that the Polish-German dispute could be settled in a peaceful manner, and that essential condition for this settlement was the elimination of the tension created by frontier incidents and exaggerated reports about these incidents. It is to be hoped, added Mr. Chamberlain, that both governments will use their best means towards preventing such incidents from occurring and checking the spreading of exaggerated reports, whose only result will be that of making the situation grow worse. The situation at this very moment, said the Prime Minister, is this. We are waiting for a reply from Chancellor Hitler to our latest communication. It depends on this reply whether it will be possible to give the several forces which are waiting for peace enough time to act. The alternative between peace and war remains. We are still hoping that peace will be maintained, and we shall work towards this. At the same time, we are resolving to follow the path we have set ourselves. Unquote. Moscow. The Tass News Agency issued the following official statement tonight. I quote, several foreign newspapers have announced that the Soviet command has withdrawn from Russia's western frontier between 200,000 and 300,000 men and has dispatched them to the east in order to strengthen the eastern frontier. The Tass agency has been authorized to state that such information is not true. Responsible quarters declare, on the contrary, that owing to the worsening of the situation in Eastern Europe and in view of any eventuality, the Soviet command has decided to reinforce the effective forces at the eastern frontiers. Rome. A number of measures designed to save increased resources in view of the present situation were adopted today. Effective September the 3rd, private motor vehicles will not be allowed to circulate except those supplied with special permits by the military authorities. Beginning tomorrow, public eating places may not supply more than one meat or fish plate. The number of the newspaper pages must not exceed 6 beginning next Thursday. Rome. An official communique issued tonight urges all those, especially old men, women, and children, who live in large cities of Piedmont, Lombardy, Liguria, Tuscany, the Lazio, Campania, Sicily, and Sardinia, and who are in a position to move to smaller towns or to the countryside, to do so by availing themselves of means of transportation while these are still available. Poland, Lithuania. Poland is feverishly constructing fortifications along her frontier with Lithuania, for fear that the latter may attempt a coup towards regaining possession of Vilno. Telephone communications between Poland and Lithuania have been suspended. The Lithuanian government has called 8 classes of reservists to the colors. London. The British government has ordered that the telephone communications between Italy and Great Britain and between France and Great Britain be suspended. An exception is made for the telephone services of the official news agencies. The postal service between Italy and Malta has been interrupted, according to a Reuters announcement this afternoon. Lisbon. Responsible quarters and the public opinion in general expect that Portugal will remain neutral if a European war breaks out. Spain's attitude is followed with keen interest in Portugal, owing to the latter's attack with the neighboring country. Paris. General Wickham has been entrusted by the French government with a special mission in the Near East. He departed from Paris for Beirut today. He was received by President Lebrun before his departure. The Hague, Holland. The Dutch government has placed an embargo on gasoline and kindred products. Berlin. The ministers of Denmark and Lithuania have received assurances by State Secretary Weizsäcker that Germany will respect the neutrality of their countries. The German minister to Copenhagen has made a similar communication to the Danish government. Warsaw. Much interest has been aroused by the suggestion of the semi-official newspaper Gazeta Polska that the problem of the German and Polish minorities in Poland and Germany, respectively, might be solved by an exchange of these minorities. It should be effected gradually so as to avoid any violent methods. Brussels. The Premier and Foreign Minister Pierlo confirmed officially tonight that King Leopold of Belgium and Queen Wilhelmina of the Netherlands have offered their mediation for a friendly solution of the present difficulties in Europe. An accord between the King and the Queen to this effect was reached last night following a telephone conversation, after which Premier Pietro called the ambassadors of Italy, Germany, Great Britain, and France, and the Minister of Poland to his office and informed them of the decision of the two sovereigns. London. In consequence of the British Admiralty's order forbidding British merchantmen to cross the Mediterranean, the vessels from Australia are now obliged to lengthen their route about 10%, those from India and China about 65%, and those from East Africa about 45%. Bucharest. The Romanian press is looking anxiously towards Rome in the hope that a peaceful solution of the present crisis may come from Il Duce. The newspaper Curentu expresses the belief that peace may still be saved thanks to Il Duce's decisive intervention. Italy, says the paper, is an active factor more than ever. Italy is the land characterized by her keen sense of measure. It will be Italy who will succeed in keeping the sinister ghost of war away from us. Bern. The presentation of men to the colors as a result of the mobilization is proceeding calmly and orderly in Switzerland. Besides the frontier troops, the mobilization includes also blasting engineers and aerial observers. Much surprise has been caused by the fact that up to this morning, France had taken no steps towards informing the Bern government of our resolve to respect Switzerland's neutrality in the same manner as Germany did last week. Ankara. The Turkish cabinet held a three-hour session today. No official statement was issued at the conclusion of the meeting. It was reported that the cabinet had taken no definite decision and seemed to be resolved to wait for further developments before deciding on the country's final stand. And that concludes our news bulletin in English this evening.
And other members of the Soviet government and of the presidium of the Supreme Soviet Republic was presided over by Comrade Zem. In the debate, the deputies unanimously welcomed the introduction of the new system of assessing the agricultural tax. The bill submitted by the Soviet government fully exempts collective farmers from paying an agricultural tax on incomes derived from workday units. The agricultural tax is to be paid only on income received by collective farmers from personal husbandry, from handicraft and other earnings. As pointed out in the debate, the new bill is directed towards stimulating in every way the extension of collective farm economy. The Soviet peasant pays considerably less in taxes than the peasants of any other country in the world. Tax payments by the collective farm and collective farmers constitute only 2.8% of the total sum of their income. After the summing up speech by People's Commissar of Finance, Vera, the bill on the agricultural tax was unanimously approved by the Soviet of Nationality as a basis. A commission was formed under the chairmanship of Deputy Vermesenko, Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic, to handle the changes and amendments to the bill advanced during the debate. A report on the second item on the agenda, Bill on Universal Military Service, will be delivered on August the 31st at a joint session of both chambers of the Supreme Soviet. A sitting of the Soviet of the Union held this evening discussed the bill on the agricultural tax. Deputies from various republics and regions of the USSR who spoke in the debate approved the bill as a measure aimed at concentrating the labor of collective farmers on the development of socialized economy, of collective farms, and of overcoming the tendency among certain collective farmers to boost their personal husbandry to the detriment of the interests of the collective farm. Deputies advanced several proposals which render the text of the bill more precise. Following the summing up by People's Commissar of Finance, Vera, the Soviet of the Union elected a commission to draft the final text of the bill, which will be submitted to the Council at one of the coming meetings with all the amendments proposed in the debate. The Soviet of the Union resolved to hear a report on the second item of the agenda at a joint sitting of both chambers on August 31st.
And that, listeners, was a brief summary of today's special session of the Supreme Soviet of the U.S. Republic.
And now listen to a journalist's impression of the session. He writes, "Today the whole world, both our enemies and friends, listens with attentive ear to the work of the special session of the Supreme Soviet of the USSR, to the voice of the deputies of the great Soviet people. The agenda of the special session, in the language of the capitalist newspapers, is a world sensation. After all, one of the 3 points on the agenda is the ratification of the Soviet-German non-aggression treaty. A glance at foreign newspapers reveals the furore in the camp of our enemies as a result of the conclusion of the Soviet-German non-aggression treaty. Yesterday, for instance, the joint session of both chambers of the Supreme Soviet learned of the resignation of the Japanese government. Reasons for the resignation were also known, for the Japanese cabinet had adopted a decision stating that Hiranuma cabinet accepts responsibility for the tremendous effect which the conclusion of the Soviet-German non-aggression treaty has had on Japanese foreign policy." But there wasn't the slightest sign of anything sensational in the hall where the Supreme Soviet is in session. There was only the usual business-like atmosphere so characteristic of the Supreme Soviet of the USSR. Calm and confidence prevail at the session where business-like people have gathered for a business-like discussion, for the solution of extremely important political problems, both internal and foreign. The people gathered in the historic Kremlin are builders of communism. They are representatives of a great and powerful nation which fears no machinations by enemies. When Comrade Stalin, together with members of the Presidium of the Supreme Soviet and other leaders of the Communist Party and Soviet government, appeared in the hall yesterday, they were accorded a prolonged party ovation. Deputies and visitors applauded. The entire Soviet people applauded. Each Soviet citizen present in the hall expressed in his stormy applause a vote of gratitude to his government and its wise policy. We Soviet people pursue our peaceful occupations calmly and confidently as befit people of a great power conscious of its strength. Yesterday, the Supreme Soviet listened to a report by Comrade Vera, People's Commissar of Finance. Vera spoke of the collective farm, of the growing prosperity of the collective farmers, of the agricultural exhibition, of the results of the victory of socialism in our country, of labor discipline on the collective farm, and of the rates of agricultural taxation. And while calmly pursuing our peaceful occupation, we are not unmindful of the threat of war, nor do we forget the that we are surrounded by capitalist countries. Our vigilance in this respect may be seen from the fact that the agenda of the session contains the draft of a bill on universal military service. We are not forgetful of the danger of war, and we are strengthening our response. At the same time, despite various provocations, we will continue to wage a struggle for peace. This may be seen from the fact that the present session will consider the ratification of the Soviet-German non-aggression treaty. This is Moscow calling. You have just heard a reporter's impression of yesterday's special session of the Supreme Court. And here is a commentary from our newspaper Pravda on the same subject. The Soviet government has placed before the special session of the Supreme Soviet three questions for consideration and approval, namely the agricultural taxation bill, a bill on universal military service, and the ratification of the recently concluded Soviet-German non-aggression treaty. The deputies to the Supreme Soviet greeted the appearance of Comrade Farr and his comrades in arms with an enthusiastic ovation. This enthusiasm and the unanimity with which all the chambers approved the agenda of the session demonstrates once again the indestructible moral and political unity of the peoples of our young socialist state, their supreme devotion to the cause of the Bolshevik fascists, and their firm determination and preparedness to complete the construction of communist society. Yesterday, the Supreme Soviet began consideration of the first question on the agenda. Comrade Zverev, People's Commissar for Finance, introduced the bill on agricultural taxation. The present law, which was adopted in 1954, played a tremendous role in consolidating the collective farm system and in raising the living standards of the masses of collective farmers. However, during the past 5 years, the situation in the Soviet countryside has changed fundamentally. The collective farms have been decisively consolidated and strengthened. The social economy of the collective farms is steadily growing and expanding. The income of the collective farms is increasing, their wealth is multiplying. As a result, income, both in cash and in time, is playing an increasingly growing role in the budget of Soviet collective farms. The present law on agricultural taxation does not provide for these great and serious economic developments. It is sufficient to point out that the law of 1954 established fixed rates of taxation on collective farmers' income, rates ranging from 10 to 50 rubles. These rates do not fully take into account the income earned by collective farmers from their personal subsidiary economy, from domestic craft industries, and from other private sources. Frequently, such a system of taxation proves to be of advantage not to the collective farmers who honestly and conscientiously participate in public collective production, but to those who shirk participation in social production and who utilize their name and rights as collective farmers to develop their personal auxiliary income, economy, and to increase their incomes from speculation and hustling. The bill presented by the government for the consideration and approval of the Supreme Soviet proposes a new method of levying agricultural taxes. According to the draft, the income received by collective farmers from the common collective farm income for workdays will be completely exempt from taxation. Moreover, the agricultural tax will affect only income derived by collective farmers from personal auxiliary economy, domestic craft industry, and from other sources not connected with the collective farm. Thus, the draft bill aims exclusively at taxing income derived from personal auxiliary economy. The bill aims at stimulating in every way possible the expansion of social economy in the collective farm and the strengthening of socialist labor discipline. The second difference between the present bill and the old law is that taxes no longer be levied according to fixed, unchangeable rates established once and for all, but according to the amount of the personal income of the collective farmers. The higher the income from personal subsidiary economy, the higher the tax. Present draft proposes a 5% to 13% tax on incomes received by collective farmers from personal subsidiary economy, and 11% to 25% tax on the incomes of individual peasant households who are not members of collective farms.
America looks ahead. This evening, we present the 38th of Elliot Roosevelt's comments on world events as America sees them. These tri-weekly discussions come to you under the sponsorship of Emerson, world's largest maker of small radio, with 63 new 1940 quality sets for every purpose and every purse. And now, Elliot Roosevelt.
Good evening, everyone. The British public and the people of the world still are in doubt as to the contents of the German note to the British government. Mr. Chamberlain went before the House of Commons this morning and in a grave speech reiterated Britain's determination to support the Poles should attempts to find a peaceful solution fail. But he did not tell England what Mr. Hitler had said. In his careful, meticulous way, he spoke of the gravity of the issues at stake and pointed out that the best interests of the people could not be served if the contents of that note were made public. From this, one must assume that Mr. Hitler's communication was a bombastic denouncement of the Poles, and the publication of this attitude would further alienate public opinion in Poland and perhaps irrevocably close the one remaining door to peace. This attitude on the part of Mr. Chamberlain is entirely in keeping with his history and his temperament. He is perhaps the most circumspect of all the statesmen in Europe. Certainly he is as moderate as Mr. Hitler is acrimonious. But I could not help but be impressed by the different routes he and Mr. Delage take to achieve the same end. Mr. Delage received a communication from Mr. Hitler, too, as you will recall. It was a remarkable and a contradictory document, in the form of a letter, but instead of withdrawing for lengthy deliberation behind closed doors, Mr. Delage flung the contents of that letter, unexpurgated and word for word, to the people. He had barely had time to read it himself before the headlines were screaming it and commentators were broadcasting it to the world. In doing this, Mr. Delage took the French people completely into his confidence, and at the same time, he made a telling appeal to public opinion. From the French viewpoint, publication of this letter and of the Delage reply to Mr. Hitler left the next step squarely up to the man in Berlin. And now that the British reply has been sent to Hitler, the impression is that once again, Mr. Delage and Mr. Chamberlain have Mr. Hitler on the hip, so to speak, because the next move, as it has been most of the time, must come from him. And so tonight, for the seventh consecutive night, the world waits in an agony of suspense. It is an experience that has no parallel in history. In 1914, there was nothing even approaching this. The crisis moved too swiftly to a head. It is interesting to recall that one of the indictments against the statesmen who failed to avert that war was that they moved in secrecy and withheld from the public their pleas for peace until it was too late. These pleas for peace were, for the most part, futile little telegrams, dispatched at the last moment in an effort to shift responsibility. Nicky and Willie and George, remember those names? Nicky and Willie and George were cousins. They sent telegrams to each other. Little personal, affectionate telegrams begging for peace. Dear Nicky, they began, and dear Willie. Willie was Wilhelm, the German Kaiser, and Nicky was his cousin. Nicky was Nicholas II, Tsar of Russia, and a cousin of George's. George was king and emperor of Britain and all the dominions beyond the sea. If you dip into the already yellowing archives of 1914, you may read these telegrams still. Little last-minute telegrams from the heads of great states, but telegrams which were withheld from the people. Telegrams which were hastily read, hastily answered, then crumpled in the hand and dropped to the floor. Dear Nicky, dear Willie, in the name of humanity, dear Willie. Cousin Willie saying, I wonder what Cousin George is thinking tonight. Do you know what I see? I seem to see dear Nicky against a wall in the bleak twilight of a Russian cellar, and an old man adorned, chopping wood with his axe and his memories. And so if the indictment of prolonged suspense may be made against the statesmen of Europe today, it cannot be said that they have worked entirely in secret, or that they are rushing the people blindfolded into a catastrophe, the end of which no living man can foretell. There are still forces on the side of peace, working and hoping that reason in some miracle of luck will prevail. And so perhaps the torment that is made of each day, a breathless epic of suspense, will be justified in the end. After all, they were shooting each other by this time in 1914. The crisis was over. It had long since passed into a state of war. Tonight, the world can point to the United States and say, here is a country in which the democratic way of life is really functioning. We in America are proud of this, but we know that there are certain definite reasons for it. One of the most important reasons is an educated and enlightened citizenry, a population aware of the problems that face America and familiar with proposed methods for their solution. I think most of us would be willing to revise our estimate of Mr. Stalin, the Russian dictator, if we analyze carefully that stunning deal he put through with Hitler the other day. Our first impulse was to think that Hitler had scored a tremendously important diplomatic victory, but the suspicion is beginning to dawn that maybe it was Stalin who scored the victory, and that Hitler has been dragged into a situation on a wild gamble that may hold fatal consequences for him. Now let's have a look at the setup and see what it means for both sides. Everyone agrees that Russia has no real territorial interest in Europe, other than the preservation of her present frontiers. But everyone knows that Russia does have, and always has had, very vital interests in the Orient, that her foreign policy has always been aimed at the destruction of Japanese influence, and that if Russia has a mortal enemy, Japan is that enemy. Several months ago, the friendship that existed between the Axis powers and Japan seemed likely to ripen into something more than just friendship. The Germans and the Italians wanted to take the Japanese into the partnership, so to speak. Such a stiffening of the line from Berlin to Tokyo was not a pleasant prospect for Mr. Stalin, who knows that someday he will have to deal forcibly with the Japanese. And so Mr. Stalin, who is not so dumb as many people believe, very cleverly permitted Mr. Hitler to lure him into an alliance that completely wrecked the Axis tie with Tokyo and left him a free hand in the East. It is hard to believe, but the evidence seems overwhelming, that Stalin is the brain in this new trust, and that Hitler has had to pay a ruinous price for what he got. It cost him the support of the Japanese, an ally whose distrust and hatred of Russia is equal to his own. It has cost him the enthusiasm of the Italian people, who are Catholic, and who see in this new tie a threat to the Catholic Church. It has cost him the support of Franco and the Spanish people, who fought with him against the very influence that he has now brought into partnership. It has dealt an embarrassing blow to German nationals all over the world, who have always justified their intense nationalism and the doctrines of the Hitler regime by insisting that Hitler was the foe of communism. So when these results are added up, it seems logical to believe that the cumbersome clod who sits in the Kremlin isn't so cumbersome after all. It seems, surprisingly, that the agile Hitler has been sold an empty package, and the wonder is that Stalin was able to do it without using chloroform. And so if we in this country are smart and really wish to be on our guard against outside influences that may ultimately have us at a disadvantage, we must stop making the fatal blunder of underestimating people we dislike. We may continue to dislike them all we choose, but it seems reasonably clear now that Stalin is anything but a bumpkin. He is an adversary of the most dangerous caliber, We think of him as uncouth and slow-witted. But ask yourself this question. How many mistakes has he made? Not many. He isn't making any now. The Russo-German Pact is another wedge in the jigsaw of war. That may not come now, but it will come sometime, and when it does come, it will find Russia on the sidelines, waiting for Europe to tear itself to pieces, so that he can move in and give communism to the people. For this he can thank Mr. Hitler, who has gone a long way toward gambling away the future of his own country and of Europe. I have always believed that the real victims of war are not those who are shot down into quick, merciful deaths, but those who come back half-dead, bringing with them strange, twisted bodies and specters in their minds that they can never quite get away from. You can walk down the street in any American city today and see men on crutches and in wheelchairs, men whose hair has begun to get a little thin on top and a little gray at the temples, and men who are dragging twisted limbs behind them and who turn away now and then and sink into paroxysms of coughing. Each paroxysm takes a little of the life out of them and brings them nearer to the release that they should have found but did not find 22 years ago. I know men whose careers have been wrecked and whose ambitions have been destroyed by the effects of war. That was the war to save the world for democracy, a war which for us began on the high, thrilling note of a bugle and has dragged along now for 22 years. To the tune of empty sleeves slapping the wind. Some of these men have sons of their own now, 18 or 19 years old enough at any rate to answer a call if a call does come. But we don't want another AEF, not this time, not an AEF made up of sons whose fathers made up the first AEF. If worse comes to worse, and if in spite of reason and courageous efforts, there must be war, then let America give, if we must give, dollars and bayonets and bandages and clothing, but not arms and legs and eyes and brains. Let us remember that the democracies of Europe have a greater need for resources than they have for manpower, and that an American expeditionary force in Europe would be a ghastly, ruinous mistake that would cancel everything we have tried to build up and save from the wreckage of the last war. Keep that in mind, won't you? Now I see that once again my time is up.